amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. If you'd like to start investing using the broker that we trust with our stocks and shares ISAs, there's a link down below to get you started. Use the code Footsie to get yourself a free share. We're also affiliated with finchat.io, which is a great source of information both Steve and I use in putting together our notes for this show. If you'd like to check it out, there's a link down below. If you use that, you can have 15% off any of the pro services. My name's Steve W, and this week, a 13F filing from Scion Asset Management revealed that Michael Burry has been buying shares in FTSE 100 oil major BP. Shares in BT jumped 25% on the news that the new CEO plans to double the company's free cash flows in 5 years. And GameStop shares went from $26 to $61 and back to $21 again. But we don't have time to talk about any of those things. There are much more interesting things going on. And to discuss them, I'm joined by Steve D. How are you, Steve? And how have you been this week?
All right. Thanks, Steve. Yeah, not a bad week. Nice to see you in high distinction on your camera. Which we had a few comments on last week. I think it was a mixture of an oldish camera on a laptop, but also just some lighting issues because we were filming it fairly late in the evening. So we took your feedback on board and we invested in a bit of equipment at Steve's end, and here he is in full HD glory for you. So I hope that feedback, let us know how it looks. We're on the same camera now, so it should be less of a transition between Steve and I when we talk. So hopefully that looks good for you. In terms of my week, though, yeah, pretty good. It's been a bit of a sluggish week in the portfolio. When he was reading out the stats before we started, I thought I was doing quite poorly, but it turns out I'm not doing as bad as that. I'm up about 0.25% on the week. I've had some decent movers for me. Nintendo is up about 8.4%. Doc Martens has moved up just over 7%. And then Palo Alto, which is a decent size position for me, 6.55. Enphase is over 5. Euronext 5.46. Fortinet 5.54. Southern Copper 5. Alphabet 4.43. But it's all getting dragged down by, you know, Amazon down 1.69%. And Disney down 2.24%. They're pretty big positions for me. So 19 up, 11 down, and what's that? 8 of them are down by less than 0.5%. So it's a bit of a flat one for me, Steve. So nothing really interesting to report there. How has your week been, Steve? Have you had a better week than me?
Largely flat as well, actually. I mean, at some point, I'm not quite sure where you get out from flat and into up or down, but you said you were plus 0.25, I am plus 0.3, which is it is 0.3, and I rounded it down to 0.3, not rounded your 0.25 up and called it 0.3. But yeah, broadly speaking, not an awful lot to talk about. Southern Copper has done about as well as it has for you as it has for me in the same week. Despite the fact that that thing has more than doubled and is closing in on tripled on mine and has clearly tripled on yours, it's still not a meaningfully big part of my portfolio that it really moves things one way or another. It's one of the smallest investments I have, even though it's up more than 100-something%. I'm glad you've still got it, though. You were talking about making a change on that a little while ago, and I guess the temptation might still be there because it's getting to be a bigger and bigger number, and the higher it goes, the less you like it, I guess. But copper's had a really good run. People are talking very positively about it for a number of different reasons, which is never a good sign. If people start talking positively about my camera as well, I'll have the thing taken back because it now get a horrendous like HD version of me and the mess behind me to have a look at. But you people asked for this, so there you are. This is what you have to look at. Outside of the markets, I've been doing some work with the foundation that I work for kind of training quote-unquote future leaders and doing some moral philosophy stuff. We were talking about the goods and the bads, the ills and the virtues of social media this time, which is a perfectly good thing that people need to think about in the world. not so much from an investment perspective, but from a kind of moral perspective. And one of the things we were wondering about in terms of whether it makes the world a better place is it becomes quite hard to distinguish kind of good from bad information, because you get quite a lot of it on social media, and you know, quite a lot of it's just made up rumor and not accurate. And someone pointed out that there was kind of a big outburst of this during the pandemic, when it seems like basically a load of white men started making podcasts who didn't really have anything much to say. I mean, obviously they'd never actually heard this show, but Steve, as the only one of us who identifies as a white man making a podcast, how do you feel about this?
It's a strange one, isn't it? Because there was that meme that was flying around at the time, and it was like, why do all podcasts look like this? And it was three cartoon characters, and it was exactly me, Paul, and Steve. So that was very disappointing. Very disappointed to see. But yeah, I'm sort of amazed that we've kept it up as long as we... Well, to be honest, I think everybody who knows me is kind of impressed that I've kept up as long as this, because I'm one of those people who, if you've ever done any of the sort of business personality tests, I'm known as a starter. I'm one of the people who starts loads of things and finishes none of them. So for me to still be doing something a couple of years in evidently means that we're still having a load of fun, Steve. So how do you feel about it? We never really ask each other this. We just sort of turn up. I wondered if both of us would be like, God, I hate it. I just thought the other Steve really likes it, and that's why I'm here. Is that how you feel?
No, I think the honest answer is that I enjoy it very much. I feel energized after it. I feel like that was really good fun. I would say it feels different sometimes now to 20 months ago. And not because we started 20 months ago, we've been doing it longer than that. But 20 months ago was when my little one was born, and life feels a bit fuller now than it did back then. But at the moment, it's still in the domain of talking about stuff we'd be thinking about anyway, in the same sense of, I feel the need to DM you less now because we can just talk about it on a whatever Thursday, Friday evening or whenever it is. This one's a Friday evening, by the way. It's May 17th here. But yeah, it's good fun. I'm enjoying it still. I wonder whether we're officially still three of us on this show or four of us on this show. Who knows? But it feels like it's good fun. I'm enjoying it quite a lot. Shall we get to things that have been happening?
It's just the fact there that you said it was actually four of us. It really was. For people who don't go far back, the first, I would say maybe 10 or 15 episodes, there was four of us. And then it went to three. And then Paul was around for quite a bit, even on and off the odd time. But yeah, it went down to two, and it's never gone back. So
yeah, it does feel like we've been doing this for quite a while. But if you think whatever it's been, three or so years now is a long time. Imagine doing this for us, or what we'll feel like when we're as old as Warren Buffett. I'm joking, obviously. Neither of us is going to live as long as Warren Buffett. But Berkshire Hathaway released their 13F this week. They always release it at the last available moment, and it's always very interesting to have a look at. There was a lot of stuff in there that was already known, like quite a significant reduction in their stake in Apple. It was talked about at the meeting. But the more interesting stuff was that the stock that they've been quietly buying without SEC disclosure for the last 9 months, three quarters or so, has finally been revealed. And I was entirely wrong about what it was. I thought it might have been Wells Fargo. It was, in fact, Chubb. Which is a Switzerland-based insurance company. Berkshire's got about, I think, $6 billion or so in there for about 6% of the company. It's now their 10th biggest investment in their stock portfolio. It's a very Berkshire-feeling business. And it's very much one that kind of makes you sit and think and go, oh yeah, afterwards. I mean, there's a little bit of not oh yeah from me, because I don't know Chubb that well, to be honest. It's not something I spent a huge amount of time thinking about, but... what I will say is it does feel like something that Buffett spent a lot of time thinking about, or indeed probably Berkshire in general and more widely. So they're in the property casualty insurance business in the US, much similar to Geico, where over half their revenues come from. And they're in essentially the same industry that Berkshire is. So the rough idea behind insurance is that you underwrite as well as you can. And you invest the profits, and you try and make as much money as you can by investing those profits. But you can only do this if you underwrite well, because if your underwriting goes wrong, it doesn't really matter how well you've invested. You're going to have to sell the things you invested in to pay the claims against your insurance. So underwriting kind of comes first. And the way we measure underwriting success is by this thing called the combined ratio that we've talked about a couple of times on this show, but very roughly you add up your costs and your amount you pay out in claims, divide that by the amount you collect in premiums, express that as a percentage, and that gets you a number. And because it's your costs over your premiums, in general a lower number is better, so you want to be paying out less of the premiums that you collect. It's effectively an upside down operating margin, and I don't know why they use an upside down operating margin rather than just turning it over and calling it an operating margin like nearly everyone else does, but I'm going to stick with the combined ratio thing for a moment, but I'll try and translate it back in a couple of cases. So look, better companies achieve lower combined ratios, i.e. they underwrite and keep more of their claims, with a kind of caveat that I'll come back to perhaps in a little bit. But Chubb, over the last 10 years, so give you a feel for how they go through a cycle, have managed a combined ratio of 89.9, so a fraction short of 90, so an operating margin of trace over 10%, which is what it is. And the average for US property casualty insurance is 97.5, so an operating margin of about 2.5%, which means that they've got a margin about four times wider than everyone else at the operating level. And that's if you look across them year by year, by the way, they've been better than the average pretty much every year. It got close one year, I think, in maybe about 2020 or so. But it's been fairly consistent that Chubb has underwritten better than the wider average. And that doesn't happen by accident. The average does contain some sort of fairly terrible outliers in it, obviously, which drags it downwards. But it's not just a kind of one-off thing. There's clear daylight between them in pretty much every year. The stock it reminds me of actually is in the UK Admiral, which we talked about a few weeks ago, where I was saying, look, these guys have a really good telematics division. That means they write better than everybody else, and it's allowing them to kind of take market share all over the place. Here's the big difference between Chubb and Admiral that I can see. I don't know whether it's telematics or something else that's doing it for Chubb, by the way, but the big difference is PE ratio, or the price of the stocks, from what I can tell. Admiral trades at around 24 times earnings, which is a lot, arguably okay for something that has a big leading position and a big technological advantage and a thing that people pretty much need, but 24 is not super low. Chubb trades at about 12, from what I can see of it, and that is quite low for something that is consistently outperforming everything else in its industry for margins. The stock obviously went up quite significantly, 8%, when it was found out that that's what Buffett had been buying. I reckon that might settle down again, though, over time. I think supply and demand will sort of balance out a little bit here. So I think it might sneak back towards the sort of 252, which is where it was the day before Berkshire's announcement. Which is where it was before Berkshire's announcement, as supply and demand normalizes a bit. It's well up since the start of the year, though, I think. So getting it at Buffett prices will be tricky. It's one of those ones where I sort of think, after the fact, couldn't I have looked at that low PE thing? It doesn't take an awful lot to tell you what I just told you there. That's not a huge, I'm not claiming that's hugely insightful analysis from me. It's a kind of brief overview of Chubb. But once you're in there, it seems like quite a capable business, to be honest. Steve, I thought I saw quite a bit to like about this. And if I'd ever not just completely dismissed it every time I'd seen it, I probably ought to have guessed this one. I didn't, so I'm not claiming any credit for it.
It's one of those businesses, Steve, that before it was announced, I wasn't even really sure what it did. For some reason, I thought it had something to do with fire extinguishers. So I think I just kind of assumed I knew what it was and assumed that it wouldn't be something I would be particularly interested in, kind of skipped over it. But I'm just reading the first quarter press release now, just as you were presenting that, Steve, and it's a fairly incredible, I mean, even if you just flick onto it to read the bold part of the top and the seven bullet points underneath it, you'll see what a fantastic business this is and just how well it's performing even as we look at this last quarter. The bit that's jumping out to me as being a little bit on the side that I wouldn't have said was kind of Buffett-like is the book value. So looking at book value per share, you're looking at about $149. and about $89 if you use tangible book value. And we're trading at 274 today, Steve. It's up 3.5% on the day, so that's a lot of a lot of money on book there. So it's a great business. You can see that it definitely deserves a premium. It's got a bit of a Buffett premium after the announcement. But is that a little bit rich? Is it something you would be more interested in earnings here than book value, or is book value the thing that would scare you off here?
Be interested to know where it was sort of back between January and March in terms of its book value. I probably should have pulled that chart, to be honest, rather than speculating about it now. But when Buffett sort of bought Allegheny, he bought it at quite a big kind of premium to the market, but pointed out that he was buying it at a price that was equivalent to 120% of book value, which for a good business that's going to sort of generate decent returns on equity, 120% of book value is absolutely fine. I think I probably would set about valuing Chubb the way I'd value a bank, which is to say, how much equity have you got? What kind of a return do you generate on it? It's an unusually good underwriting thing. And when I looked at Admiral, actually, Admiral is just, as I saw it, an unusually good underwriting thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being unusually good at underwriting, but its investment returns bit is not terribly strong. They pick up about 2% and a bit, which is quite weak. It's not easy to be, right, Berkshire. There's a number of reasons why it's unlikely there'll ever be another one, partly because of the time when Buffett was getting going with the things like National Indemnity. But, I think it might be kind of, I mean, there was indication that they've been buying in the last quarter as well, so they haven't stopped particularly. I wonder. I'd be interested in comparing those returns on equity measures with price to book at some point for this thing. Well,
return on equity, you're getting about 14%, and that's with double-digit top line as well. So that's going to end up, it's one of those businesses you're probably buying it a couple of years in the future, really, aren't you? But it's such a premium, fairly steady performer. Well, they quite comfortably exceed market performance in terms of the insurance market, so you might not be buying it as far forward as that. It does look like a fantastic business. My question to you, Steve, off air was, is this something that Berkshire would go off and buy straight away? And your retort was, well, it's over £100 billion business, but isn't he sitting on the best part of $250 billion in cash, Steve? It's not even half of it to buy out this business at this kind of rate. And it does look like the sort of business he could tack on to his insurance business, and it would be a fantastic addition. But also, I wonder if the regulators let this go through. I wonder if that makes too big of an insurer. That would be an interesting one. Thoughts?
I'm not sure what I make of the regulator here. I think to strengthen your sort of point, to be honest, if you think for the moment that Berkshire wants to keep more cash around than would permit them to buy Chubb at the moment, you could always sell part of your stake in Apple, say, and realize some cash like that, especially if you think there was a sort of tax incentive to do so. There's plenty of money tied up in that thing that could be used to help finance an acquisition. So I sort of wonder, because that was discussed at the annual meeting, right? The selling Apple thing. And Buffett said, look, in this environment, I don't mind having a bit more cash around and a bit less invested in Apple, even though Apple will still be our largest stock holding for blah blah however long. That will be true, of course, if they bought Chubb in its entirety, because Chubb would come off the marketable securities list for the company. But I wouldn't be massively surprised, only in that I'm not sure this selling Apple thing makes much more sense, unless I kind of thought at the time, yeah, what do you want more cash for? You already got more cash than anybody knocking around. And I get that interest rates are all right, but Buffett has said historically that high interest rates are the time to run into stocks, not to run into cash. And the reason is that interest rates eventually go down sooner or later. And when they do, stock prices go up and it becomes harder to buy stocks. Then you're sat on a load of cash that's not worth much. And I don't think that's something he would have changed his mind on particularly. I mean, he might, but that doesn't seem to me like, that seems to be quite a well thought out Buffett view, put it that way. On the, could he be lining up something like a massive move for Chubb? I wouldn't rule it out, but I'd be interested to see if they keep buying going forward from this, because it's not hugely kind of beaten down. It just looks like reasonable-ish or steady-ish value to me at these kind of levels.
Yeah, I agree with that, Steve. I think that's, yeah, that's kind of the take, I think. Yeah, I hope he doesn't do that thing that he has been doing recently, where you sort of like, we sit there and figure out for half an hour why we think he's gone into something, and then the next report he realizes that he's sold a lot of it, or sold all but like 0.1% or something. But maybe this has something to do with Greg Abel taking over the buying reins at Berkshire. That was announced at the meeting that Greg's going to essentially overview or have the final say on all equity positions. Buffett is stepping back essentially, or completing the step back, depending on how you view the sort of the sort of phasing transition of power that they've been going through. Could this be something that Greg really admires and, you know, he wanted to add to the portfolio? It's really difficult to tell. There has been no definitive answer on that yet. So it looks like a fantastic business, though, Steve. So not one you're planning to add to the portfolio yourself, then?
Probably not. I mean, it's, the more I look at it, the more I think I ought to have, and the more I think if I do it now, that's just terrible. You can't just be buying stuff. You can't be kind of whatever the opposite of front-running is, back-running. Buffett's purchases, if you're going to do that, you might as well just buy Berkshire Hathaway, right? And buy him at least at the same time that he does, rather than immediately afterwards. I do think it's a very good buy. Greg Abel takes over capital allocation. What I heard in that meeting is that there's going to be less money in equities and more going into stuff like investing in the utilities business and Berkshire's kind of wholly owned subsidiaries, where it sees growth opportunities there. That to me looks more like what Greg Abel is good at than, I won't say picking stocks, because Buffett doesn't like that expression, but I don't see him as a stock market guy particularly. I see him as an operations guy, which is, if anything, better thing to be at, I think. Or I'd rather have someone who's going to run that part of the business well, but I'm not sure I view it as a Greg Abel thing. I also don't think, here we go, famous last words, but you can catch this if you want. I also don't see this as being gone in 6 months' time, like either a Taiwan Semi or a Verizon, which was kind of hidden for quite a while and then suddenly gone. Verizon felt like a kind of capital-intensive dividend thing to me for low interest rates. Chubb doesn't feel like that. It's not got a massive dividend yield, despite quite a low PE. So it tells you there's quite a lot going on within that company, which tells me I think they might be going to hang on to this. Time will tell on this, and so no doubt time will prove me wrong. But I would be leaning towards the idea that they either keep or add to Chubb over time, rather than letting it go within the next, let's say, 12 months, extending it out that way. But always good fun to be Buffett watching, and always nice when there's something new to talk about, rather than sort of small things fiddling around the kind of 1% of the portfolio mark, and then you're guessing at whether it's Buffett or Todd or Ted or whoever. And it's really stabbing in the dark, and there's not much value to be had by doing that. But something big like Chubb is nice to talk about every once in a while.
Yeah, nice to see a positive move with a bit of scale behind it as well. So, yeah, interested to see where that one goes, really. I think off to a cracking start on it. Yeah, interesting one to cover in the future. Steve, do you want me to pop onto Euronext?
Yep, Euronext.
Right, okay. So this is a stock that I think I pitched this one. I'm not sure if I did or not, but I talked about it on the show quite a little bit. But I've definitely talked about it a lot in my pie. So if anybody follows the pie, I have been asked a couple of times why Euronext, especially after I sold the London Stock Exchange Group. People were like, why keep Euronext? Why sell? why sell the London Stock Exchange Group. So I'll just quickly run over the sort of thesis there, really. So it's the number one equity listing venue in Europe. It's got about 1,900 listed companies with about 7.1 trillion euros in market cap when you add them all together. It's the number one cash trading venue in Europe. About 25% of shares traded in the European region in 2023, about 9.8 billion in the adjusted daily value. It's the number one debt listing venue globally, has about 57,000 bonds listed with it. It's the number one ETF traded venue in Europe. It's about 3,820 ETFs listed with it. It's got a leading multi-asset class clearinghouse with about 120 million contracts cleared. And it's the third largest CSD network with about 6.9 trillion in assets under custody in their post-trade franchise. And you get this, Steve, for about 9.4 billion euros all in, which if you just go back 10 years, it was 1.4 billion market cap. It's up 6.5%, back then revenue was 458 million. It's now 1.5 billion. So that's up 3.3 times. And the EBITDA margin has grown from about 42% to nearly 60%. So, you know, what do you like, Steve? Top line growth, profitable growth leads to share price growth. It's the very example of the stock market being a weighing machine. So look, as part of the LSEG deal to acquire Refinitiv, one of the things it had to do was sell the Borsa Italiana, which is the Milan exchange, to Euronext. And it had to do that because Europe was concerned that London had far too much control over over the markets in general over there. And I think a little bit of them wanted to maybe take clearing for EU companies and make it happen on EU shores. Milan was probably seen as a bit of a dog because it had really low levels of IPOs. The number of companies in the Milan Stock Exchange has actually been falling. Corporate buyouts have been removing companies from the exchange. And if you really wanted to focus in on that deal at the time it was purchased, it looked like a bit of a bum deal. But it was there was a little bit more under the radar. So it came with an in-house clearing arm, which meant that Euronext no longer needed to use LSEG to finalise its trades. And it was coming to the end of the deal at the point where they acquired this. So they needed to pay about 38 million euros to release themselves from the deal. So it was going to do this. It was going to do this by 2025, but it's actually pushed forward with the split now, and it pretty much does the vast majority of clearing, you know, on EU shores. So just quickly, because I understand I'm using terms that are somewhat technical. So a clearinghouse is kind of like a middleman in a financial transaction. So it ensures that everything runs smoothly between buyers and sellers. The breakdown of its key functions are really that it reduces risk. It sort of acts as an intermediary. So that reduces the chances of one party sort of failing to hold up their side of the deal. It validates transactions, so it checks that transactions and details are for both parties are good and true and valid and can transact before they go through. But they also guarantee settlement. So once everything checks out, the clearinghouse guarantees that the buyer will, you know, receive the financial instrument and security, and that the seller will get the payment. So it reduces risk in that sort of like holistic middleman kind of model. They play a vital role, clearinghouses, in sort of maintaining stability and reducing risk in financial systems. And I guess the best way to think about them is kind of like a referee of a financial transaction. They make sure that the game is played fair and everyone follows the rules. And then they just take a little fee, a little slice of everything there to make sure that happens. So here's a quick summary of the key points from Euronext Q1 2024 earnings. It's up quite a bit on the week. I thought these were pretty decent earnings. Tell me what you think in the comments section. Revenue growth. So Euronext reported about 8% increase in revenue. This was a record 401.9 million euros for Q1 2024. The growth was primarily driven by strong performance in non-volume related businesses such as post-trade and trading services. Clearing revenue jumped 23%. This is what they've taken away from LSEG and brought in-house by using the Milan exchange. It's called CC&G, the clearinghouse for Euronext. And I'm not going to try and pronounce it because that is an Italian name. And I know one of the C stands for compassionate. Anyway, so trading was up 7.4%. Post-trade was up 11.5%. Data solutions was up 5.5%. Listing and services was up 5.5%. And technology was down 3.3%. In terms of expense management, they successfully reduced their underlying expenses by about 2% year over year. So they reckon they've now got an adjusted EBITDA margin of about 62.5%. They're still progressing with this 2025 deadline of the Borsa, integrating the Borsa Italiana group. They reckon they've found about 79 million euros in cumulative run rate synergies. And they think that by the end of this next quarter, there'll be about 115 million to be found in terms of synergies. So we should see further increased profitability as we go along this year. They said that the revenue streams were diversified, significant revenue contributions coming from listings, from data services and diversified trading activities, including both what they call fixed income and power trading. Net income grew by 11.7% to 164.2 million euros. Adjusted EPS grew by 15% to €1.58. They've got a pretty healthy looking balance sheet at the moment, Steve. Net debt to adjusted EBITDA ratio of about 1.6x. And the S&P just recently upgraded their company rating to BBB+, BBB+, and gave it a positive outlook as well. In terms of the future focus, they're committed to innovation, exploring strategic opportunities, and they've got plans to discuss these a little bit further on an investor day that they've got at the end of this year. For the quarter ending March 31st, EPS growth of a euro 35, growth of about 49% compared to the same period of last year. And you get all of that, Steve, that business there for about 17 times earnings. It's about 16 times forward earnings. You get a decent 2.3% dividend, although you're going to get French transaction tax when you buy it, and you're going to get a withholding tax as well when it's paid. I think it's 30% for people in the UK, so maybe not as healthy when you work that out. But there's growth here, Steve, and I think it's still pretty cheap, even though it's up about 17% this year. Steve, I know you don't know an awful lot about Euronext, and I kind of sprung this one on you, about half an hour before we were due to start. But you do know a little bit about LSEG, and how do these kind of numbers stack up if you're comparing them?
Well, a couple of things about the numbers here. One is it's a lot cheaper than LSEG typically is on a PE ratio basis, and there's not PEs aren't everything in the world, and I take that point, but neither Euronext nor LSEG, in fairness, has a particularly worrisome looking balance sheet. They're both sort of fairly strong from what I remember of them. So I'm actually sort of thinking that you can take that 16-17 as pretty close to being about right. And for a business that is close to a monopoly, I realized that recently we've been learning that LSEG is not a monopoly, that things can just take themselves off and list themselves elsewhere if they like, at least for that part of the business. I know LSEG is now mainly Refinitiv. I wonder whether that actually breaks down the comparison a little bit here. So with LSEG, the business breakdowns that we listened to sort of years ago now, crikey, we've been doing this a long time, involved the guy partly emphasizing the fact that there's a G in LSEG of London Stock Exchange Group, and it does a whole bunch of things, and those things include Refinitiv, which now makes up, I think it's more than half their revenues by this point. So different types of business, and maybe there's a justification if you like the sort of data business better. And in an AI kind of emerging environment, you may well think that there's a good reason to. Looking at this, though, I thought the function of a clearinghouse, when we've talked about it before, was to get the likes of you and me to try and work out what numbers come after trillions. When we sort of talk about how much gets cleared through LSEG, certainly, we tend to, or you at any rate, tend to talk in the quadrillions, and I sort of just imagine lots of noughts in my head going through these. But these are huge, huge things, and adding on bits, LSEG's been a story of kind of actually pretty smart M&A is what's kind of moved it forward. Actually, as its kind of stock exchange business sort of slides backwards a little bit, as things tend to prefer to list away from the UK, unless they're Shein, in which case they're considered too dodgy for everywhere else, so they might come to the UK. Terrific. But even as that business slides backwards, they kind of have good M&A elsewhere. And I think that might be what you're kind of seeing with Euronext here, right? And the Milan kind of acquisition attaches on a clearing arm, etc. Synergy, save costs, and that sort of thing. Smart M&A can work in this sector. I think that's probably the lesson that I've seen from this before now, and kind of how I react to what's going on here. 8% revenue growth, 15% EPS growth, things going at 16, 17 PE, that's close to a peg of one. Reasonably hard to disrupt business, growing at a pretty reasonable rate. That seems quite impressive. I will take a closer look. I am automatically put off by anything that comes with sort of fairly high taxes. But a while ago, Steve, you asked me, would I consider anything from the from Europe? I've been looking. I haven't found it yet. Maybe this is the answer.
Potentially, Steve. I think this is one of those steady investments to just stick in the bottom of your portfolio and let its top line grow up, you know, 5 to 8% for you know, for the foreseeable future. I think that's something that this company can do for a long time, especially as it continues to integrate clearing services back onto EU shores and away from LCH Clearinghouse. Just growing at 8% top line, Steve. It's what, 9 years to double your top line using Rule of 72 here. You know, that's a decent return, Steve. If you're doubling your money every 9 years on a stock, you know, if you can find 10, 15 stocks that do that in a portfolio of 30, Steve, you're doing really, really well. And I really like this. And comparing it against something like LSEG, it needs a lot less kind of imagination. So you look at that LSEG earnings and you say, look, you know, that earnings, price to earnings is whatever it is, it's high. But you go in there and you factor in all of these costs that you know that you can strip out at some point, and you get to a sort of a theory of where you know, where LSEG is probably going to end up being. And you're thinking, well, actually, if I factor those things in now, and if I, you know, these one-time costs, I scrub them off, then you've got, you know, LSEG a decent valuation. You don't need to do any of this with Euronext. It's all here right in front of you. It's a much simpler sort of, in terms of, you know, an income statement to understand and process at a decent rate. And yeah, that's the main reason why I swapped LSEG for Euronext. It was LSEG was up quite handily for me, and I thought, you know, the risk of my thesis being that, you know, these one-time costs don't end up coming up and they just keep finding a new reason to restructure or finding a new reason to mess around was too much for me, especially when I had Euronext sat there looking at me going like, look, I'm going to just grow at, you know, 7 or 8% a year, and, you know, what happens to my share price will happen. It's going to be one of those stocks, I think, that in 10 years time will be a, you know, a much bigger company. Whether the share price moves or that is not really something we can control, but I think what we've got here is a steady performer with a good balance sheet, with a good credit rating, good outlook, a decent growth on the top, and a little flywheel underneath there that we can, you know, we can look at as something that will probably bring a bit more future growth.
LSEG's currently at a PE ratio of about 68 for comparison. And as you point out, that comparison is probably not apt. There's a lot going on that you need to try and factor for with LSEG. But it feels like it's always been this way, to be honest, with LSEG, at least as long as we've been looking at it. There's always been kind of one-time costs. And I was listening to a guy called Charlie Huggins a few weeks ago who was saying, sort of be wary of companies when they're constantly saying, ah, this one-off thing. If you're a serial acquirer and you want to strip out your one-off costs from acquisitions, that's fine. But if you're planning on replacing them with more acquisition costs when you do more acquisitions in the future, because that's what you do, you don't necessarily get to treat them as one-time costs, even though those specific ones are one-time costs. It feels a bit like our kind of household budget, to be honest. Every month we think, oh yeah, we had that kind of one-off thing that doesn't happen more than once a year, so it's the car or something. But then there was another month where it was a load of birthdays or something. And none of those comes around every month. They're not recurring expenses, but there's a different one every damn month, and the money seems to go out every time on it. So it's been, I'll be honest, I haven't looked at LSEG since about December or so. I seem to remember being sat in a It was dark outside and cold, and I think it was December because I was still looking at a lot of things back then around the sort of end of year period. I might take another look, but I might also take a look at Euronext while I'm at it on this.
Yeah, and just to finish, really, Steve, the market likes what Euronext has been doing this year a lot more than it likes LSEG. If you just look at the year to date, so I think Euronext is about 17%. I think LSEG's about 2%, and that is in a period of time when the FTSE 100 has done, you know, really well. It's fired onto all time highs. So, I think it's an interesting one. Anyway, I'd be really interested to hear what other people think about it in the comment section, whether it's one they've come across. I know it used to be part of, I think it was Intercontinental Exchanges, but got spun out of it. So it's now operating independently again. So I wonder if that's something that they probably look at now and think, oh, I wish we held on to that. It's gone down a very interesting path and forged a pretty decent part of the market for itself.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Shall we have a look at something else from the UK?
Let's go.
So, Diploma, one that I didn't give Steve very long to think about, but you know more about Diploma on a kind of off-the-cuff basis than I do about Euronext. Let's see how we go. Stock is up 7.5% this week, which is, I don't know, it feels like about an average week for Diploma, to be honest. But they released their six-month report at the start of this week, and they had a nice pop-off of that as well. This is kind of on paper an expensive stock, but it speaks to a couple of themes that we've been talking about so far, or that I've been talking about anyway. So their organic sales growth was around 5%. Margins went up from 18.8% to 19.6%. And earnings per share reached 65.1p, which is 10% up, maintaining their track record of 10% earnings per share growth, they said. Now, there is a catch with that. That's because that number is adjusted earnings per share growth. And look, if you adjust your earnings per share, it's quite easy to maintain 10% growth if you just keep adjusting things around all over the place. So the obvious question becomes, what were they adjusting it for? Their basic earnings per share are down 9%. So what's the kind of difference here? The answer is a one-off disposal that was bumping the earnings up kind of last time. So if you try and factor that out, and Diploma is quite an acquisitive and it doesn't dispose of things terribly often, but it does do quite a lot of M&A. That's part of the nature of the business here. So I get you to think about that as you will on that one. But adjusted earnings per share are up 10%, as they have been since forever, because if they're not, just adjust them until they are. Their three divisions, which are controls, seals, and life sciences, they were all up, which is actually kind of impressive in the sort of environment that they've been in. It's not been a terribly good period for things like construction or engineering or manufacturing or any of that stuff just recently. But it does speak to the point that both of us have made about this company several times now, that if you're selling kind of bits that are mission critical but inexpensive, you get a bit of protection from the business cycle as things kind of dial down. Even when kind of things aren't going well, no one's going to stop their plant or machine or whatever operating because they're missing a nut or a washer or need a replacement cable or something like that. So being paid for out of OPEX budgets really does do something for holding up this company through the cycle. They're guiding pretty strong as well. They're looking for sort of growth on pretty much all their fronts, which is sales, margin, and cash conversion. And one of the things I think about this that stands out to me is that, aside from adjusting things all over the place, which is that's a very good way to make your numbers go up, but you only need a little bit in each of these things to add up to quite a significant jump in the end. Mid to high single digit revenue, mid to high single digit margin, mid to high single digit cash conversion. Admittedly, they're now up around the 90% cash conversion, so they haven't got many more percentage points to wring out of that. It only takes a bit, though, on each of these things to start magnifying each other and actually turning into some quite steady growth. They've managed about 12 deals in the last 6 months, including the one that we talked about a few weeks ago. Company called Peerless Aero Fasteners. They did that at a pretty low EBIT multiple because they seem to be able to do that. And they are very much a company that you always worry about acquirers a little bit, that they might go mad and just keep buying stuff for the sake of it. Both these guys and Halma, actually, who is another similar but kind of not sort of exactly the same FTSE 100 high-performing conglomerate type thing, they report in their annual report and indeed in their kind of trading updates, their return, something approaching their returns on invested capital. They don't call it the same thing in each case, but they have a a returns metric that they report, which I think helps them stay accountable in terms of overpaying for stuff. Because if you overpay for stuff, then you will send out a load of capital and your return on whatever capital will go down. And you'll have to tell your shareholders about that. Unless, of course, you adjust it and then it won't go down. It might go up again or go wherever, but go where you want. The big thing with Diploma is price. When I wrote about it earlier this week, I said it was at a PE of 42. It's now at a PE of about 49. And by FTSE 100 standards, that is enormous. It's not low by anyone's standards, but it's very, very high. It implies a sort of 2% earnings yield. Okay, so you get 90% of that converted back into cash, which is not bad, but it's about half the rate of a government bond for 10 years. So you're looking at sort of roughly 12% earnings growth for the next 10 years to try and match the performance you would get from a bond. You would slightly outperform it if you managed 12% over each year for the next 10 years. If there was a company that I was going to bet on to do it from the FTSE 100, I'd probably stick it on Diploma, to be honest. I can't think of, unless I could find a massive cyclical downtrodden thing, which I don't think I can. I think even something like Carnival is recovering well enough. That I think I wouldn't back you for 12% per year for 10 years. I think Diploma would be my pick for if you said, look, find me something that's going to grow. I don't really care about anything else. Its own stock is expensive, mind you. I've thought that for a long time, and it got a lot more expensive since I was thinking it, along with some good moves along the way. But I sold this when it was at a PE ratio of something quite high. A little while ago, it's now at a PE ratio of something very high. It's a better business in terms of it's done more M&A, it's boosted its earnings, it's done what appear to be smart deals. That said, I am struggling to find my way back into this at the moment, Steve, at these levels, and yet I do not expect it to come down.
No, I think, yeah, I can totally see that. I'm just looking through these. I mean, there's not a lot of information in these half-year results, but there's enough to sort of show you just how well they're performing. So it looks like you're getting essentially 66.5 million in free cash flow here for your money. And everything here just looks good. There is some strange things in here, Steve, that are jumping out at me. There's 284 million invested in 6 quality acquisitions, including Peerless for 236 and PAR Group for 38. So that's 274 of it, the 284 million. So there's 4 acquisitions in there for 10 million.
Small stuff, that. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and you would imagine some of them are probably, you know, might be 4 or 5 million. So there might be some in there that are just a few hundred thousand. So, and it sort of begs the question of, you know, why would you bother? And the answer to that really is that because Diploma can make those businesses better, and under Diploma's wings, they make Diploma better. So they are one of those companies that will, you know, they are serial acquirers of companies that can help serve the markets that they serve. And it doesn't really matter of the size of it. The Diploma are more interested in sort of, you know, keep acquiring, keep growing. And you can see that backing them to grow in the way that you want, Steve, I think is probably going to happen. You've got a 28% growth in free cash flow there, if that is the figure that you're gonna focus on, I guess. You know, they're going to churn it out here, I think is what I'm going to say. And they, you know, they do it with discipline. They've got a very conservative balance sheet. They're growing pretty much everywhere. I understand why they're adjusting 0.9x leverage. It is a fantastic business that we have admired for too long, and neither of us have owned for long enough. And I don't know, Steve, I can understand why you're struggling here, but I think it might be one of those where you have to do it through a bit and knuckle, if you know what I mean. You have to kind of just go, I'm going to have to... Because I'm the same as you. I would back these guys to outperform over the next 10 years. The market is telling you they have to, essentially, to keep this PE ratio, to earn a decent return off where they are at the moment. And the market is telling you that out of everybody, they're quite likely to do it. And I would be inclined to believe them and to believe you as well, Steve.
It's a bit of a Costco, isn't it? In the sense of it's never going to screen well. You're never going to kind of see it as, and genuinely in both cases, growth is getting harder for the businesses, but in both cases, it's not at the point where it's hard yet. You could have bought Costco, I don't know, 5 years ago at 30-odd times earnings, and you'd done great since then. And it would now look cheap at 30 times 5 years ago's earnings. Exactly the same thing is true of Diploma. Costco can't keep opening stores at the same to support the same growth rate that it historically has, but that's been true since it started. And it just seems to kind of keep going impressively. Diploma, M&A, well, I don't know what their M&A prospects look like. They're actually pretty optimistic on them, but eventually M&A becomes an issue. It's become an issue for every high-performing conglomerate in history once it reaches a certain size. But the thing is, when I look across the Atlantic, the other sort of high-performing conglomerates, the ones sort of identified by Mark Leonard at Constellation Software, I mean, he makes the point that historically what happens is these things eventually achieve worse returns because their size makes them buy stuff at higher prices that's less good. Berkshire's a good example. But Diploma's nowhere near the size of some of these things yet. It's still tiny in comparison to stuff. I mean, you see it going up like an absolute weed, trading at huge numbers of earnings, huge multiples of earnings and so on, and think, well, you know, that can't go on forever. And equally, it hasn't gone on. It's gone on for a fair old while, but it's still not a massive market cap object thing. I could see myself looking at this at three times this market cap and saying, oh, I think it's probably at about a size now where it's starting to get to the point where it might have a challenge. I don't care if it grows, it triples, then what do I much, why am I bothered about that when the thing eventually switches over into buyback mode or whatever it does?
Do you think some of the fear that people get from this stock is that they pull up that max chart and see, you know, that it started at essentially a pound and it's now at nearly £42?
Yep.
But they're not looking at the chart in like a log scale. And if you look at it in log, it would probably look a lot less like, you know, you're joining now at the top of a very high cliff. I see what you mean, Steve, just looking at it. I didn't realize it got into the 5 billion ranges, but it's now 5.62 billion in terms of market cap. And like you say, it is having a fairly decent year, up 21.5%. But, you know, 16%, they're guiding for revenue growth here, Steve. Now, some of that is organic. I think only about 6% and about 10% of that is from their acquisitions. But that's still decent growth, Steve. I mean, we'll go back to the rule of 72 again. It's only 4.5 years for, you know, if they can do that for 4.5 years, that's a double top line. And they keep screwing down margins. They keep generating more and more free cash flow. You know, it might just be one of those things where, you know, you just have to, at some point, you're going to have to, if sometimes you want it, it's a quality business, you want it in your portfolio, at some point you're going to have to, you know, dive in feet first and make the purchase.
Yeah, I was just looking at some of the kind of US conglomerates that I've been sort of thinking about recently, and you get these are kind of under the radar good things. They show up on sort of Dividend King lists because they're really good, but Dover Corporation is $25 billion. These are dollars, $25 billion. Illinois Tool Works is $74 billion. Amatech is $38 billion. These are all like at least four times the size of Diploma, depending on how you think of this. So I kind of really wonder as to whether there isn't the scope for this to keep doing better. I'm talking myself into this thing quite a bit, and I'm sat on a portfolio where just at the moment, nearly all of it is green, and I hate buying things when they're green. So the solution is to buy something else, even if it's a less good buy than the things I currently own that are all green. I don't know what I'll do about this. I will tell you at the end of Q2, so the end of June. I'll let you know if I did something about Diploma on this one, but we will see. Steve, more victory laps for you, though, it seems.
Yeah, despite having a name that sounds like something like your boomer father would say on the beginning of a week, Monday.com has been a pretty decent winner for me, and they've had some their earnings out this week, and they've had a decent reaction. They're only up about 26% on the week. and on the year it's about 29%. But I'm going to just quickly shoot through the earnings. You guys let me know what you think in the comment section. I think this is still, I mean, we highlighted this stock when it IPO'd as being something that was a bit of a cream of the crop kind of stock. And the market agreed with us at the time and sent it up into the $400 kind of dollar range, which was quite a lot for the stock. It IPO'd about $180, if I remember correctly. But it got all the way back down to $90, and we were still highlighting it back there, Steve, as something that we thought was a really good stock. And anybody buying it there in the sort of 100 range now is up, well, it's over a double anyway. So, and that's only in the case of about a year's time, maybe a year and a bit. So, so yeah, first quarter 24 earnings, revenue was up 34% to $217 million. Gross profit, if you've listened to previous shows, you'll know this is really high. The margin's about 89%, but that was up 100 to 193 million. That's up 33%. Non-GAAP net income, $32 million. That's up 338%. It's about a 15% margin. In terms of operating cash flow, about $92 million, up 115%. That's about 42% margin. And free cash flow of $90 million, up 132%. That's a margin of about 41%. Paid customers with over 10 users, that's now at 55,515. That's up about 18%. Paid customers spending over 50K over the year, that's now 2,491. That's up 48%. And paid customers spending over 100K is at 833. That's up 55%. Now, there was some sort of smallish declines in net dollar retention rate, but this is kind of explained a little bit later on. Net dollar retention rate was 110%. For over 10 users, it's 114%. For over 50K spenders, it's 114%. And for over 100K, it's 113%. So pretty decent, pretty strong. And just that is the amount that they can essentially take out of their customers every year is a layman's term for net dollar retention rate if you don't understand that metric. So essentially they're increasing their price, or they're generating more revenue by about 14%, essentially. A net dollar retention rate of 100 means that the customer who spent, you know, $1 million with you last year spends $1 million with you this year. Yeah, at 14%, it'd be 1.14 million, just to kind of lazily explain that to you. In terms of guidance, Steve, so they said they think they'd do about $230 million in the next quarter. That's up 31%. They reckon they'll do about $21 million in EBIT. That's about a 9% margin, and they'll do about $51 million in free cash flow, which is about 22% margin. And on the full year, they raised their guidance across the board. They said they'll do about $948 million in revenue. That's a 30% jump year over year. EBIT of about $83 million. That's keeping that 9% margin, which was a decent raise. And they think they'll do about $244 million in free cash flow, Steve, which is a margin of about 26%, which is another raise. And there's a few things in the call that were quite interesting. So they said that the CRM and development products are experiencing strong growth. This is driven by new customer acquisitions and essentially that they've been doing quite a bit of cross-selling strategy. So they said that they've recently adjusted their pricing strategy, Steve. I had a little look at that, see what it meant. And what they've done is they've hiked up the prices. But they said they've actually exceeded expectations in terms of their customer retention and churn. The full impact of these changes, they are expecting it to materialize in the next 12 to 15 months as annual contracts begin to come up for renewal. And it's a kind of watch this space in that department. There's continued movement in the small and medium business segment, and they're sort of progressing and engaging larger enterprise customers. They think investments are continuing to be made into the platform, the sort of market approach and the sales team to support this as they expand. Financial health, I mean, Q1 showed really strong free cash flow performance, influenced by improved cash collection from small and medium businesses, a bit of interest income, and the timing of some expenses. The company is confident in achieving about a 25% annual free cash flow margin in the near future. And in terms of AI capabilities, Steve, because I know everybody likes to hear about that, There's some new AI features that they've released. They're seeing really positive initial adoption. They expect this will enhance the platform stickiness and automation for their customers over the next coming years. And in terms of business outlook, they think that despite the ongoing sort of macroeconomic uncertainties that we have at the moment, they're really optimistic about their business and really optimistic about the financial performance. And I think, Steve, on those numbers, it's pretty hard not to be. In terms of valuation, you're not looking at something that's going to be particularly pretty on first glance here. You know, you're buying the future of this business. You're not looking at it now thinking, you know, this is dirt cheap. You're looking at about 11.2 billion market cap and a PE ratio, Steve, that I work out as being in the 500s. But I wouldn't worry about that too much at the moment. It's not a company where you want to look at that PE ratio and think, though, that's scary. Because they're not really focused on making ends at the moment. They're focused on getting as big as they can. And I think it was Jason Moser who said, would you rather they stopped growing the top line and focused on efficiencies and you know, started churning out profit for you? Or would you rather them get as big as they absolutely could, as fast as they absolutely could, and grab as much market share as they could, and then start focusing on efficiencies? And I think that is, you know, the sort of mentality you've got to have when investing in a stock like this. I think it does well from here, Steve. Is it one you've ever considered? Is it in your realm?
It's probably not in my realm. I think that was Bill Mann, by the way, but you're on the right show, who said, I think it was of Mercado Libre, perhaps. What would you have them do? Would you have them pay you a dividend and bring down their PE ratio right now, or would you have them get as big as damn possible? And it's a great question for a couple of reasons. One is it tells you whether you're thinking about this company right and just whether this is a right type of company for you. If you're not prepared with the idea that they're going to say, look, if you need your companies to be within your screening metrics at all times and you're going to sell them if they wander out of them, this isn't going to work out terribly well, or you're going to have to think of some different metrics to use. But I was having a look at FinViz while you were talking about that. They work out the PE ratio of this company. I'm not saying they're right necessarily, to be about 610, which is where they're at with this. So a fraction higher than you thought. They also have a forward PE ratio, though, of about 79, which is high, but significantly lower than 610. And that's kind of that's one of the things that I sort of, you can kind of keep an eye on with these kind of metrics. If you really insist on looking at PE ratios with this type of stock, and maybe that's a psychological thing that you need to do, remember that the bigger they are, the harder they fall. So, you know, 10% growth off of a 600 PE ratio chops 60 off the PE ratio. 10% growth off of a 15 PE ratio chops 1.5 off it. So, and this, by the way, you said was growing its net income at about 338% a year or so. So that that chops quite a bit off of your 600 thing. It's I don't know what's predicted into that kind of 80 forward number, but it comes down a fair bit. That last bit is harder to, you know, from 20 to 15 is harder to chop down than it is from 600 to 500. But it's worth noting, I think, that the metrics there aren't necessarily as ugly as they look. I was listening to Brian Stoffel talking about stocks he's been selling recently, and that's not really a Monday.com thing, but he did say he's been selling Atlassian, and one reason he said he's been selling Atlassian is he's unsure about its moat and ability to fend off competition from the likes of Monday.com, are a good example here. Monday.com was kind of falling away a little bit as a stock, and its earnings have given it a big old push. It's now up at around the sort of $228 mark, but it's bumping up against historic resistance levels, according to FinViz. Make of that what you will. I make of it nothing. But it's definitely kind of historically high, but it's also a historically high-earning business. It's never been making this much money before, and its prospects have probably never looked better. I quite like the idea that quite a few people have sort of decided, well, it seems like every shop I go in has reassessed their pricing strategy lately, by which they mean whacking up prices of everything. I always think with these kinds of businesses, if anything is, and I'm not necessarily sure that I think anything is, but if anything is, these are acyclical businesses. They're secular growers. They're supposed to push higher through the kind of economic cycle, these kinds of techie things. So I guess I'm not massively surprised for you at your point that, yes, through a different kind of macro economy, they've kept growing. I think that's sort of what they're meant to do. But it is good to see them doing what they're meant to be doing. And there was certainly some kind of, there'd been a fair bit of pessimism around these sorts of things before. It'll be interesting to me to see who emerges as out of the winner out of Monday Atlassian and a bunch of other things as well. It's not clear to me that there are no switching costs in these cases. So I feel like it's probably not necessarily winner take all here, but I feel like they're all kind of racing to sign people up to a similar-ish sort of product, and getting there fast is important, which is another reason that you probably don't want to worry too much about the right now earnings, or you don't want to buy this stock unless you have a 10-year outlook. And I'm not sure you want to buy much if you have less than that, to be honest. So I think this makes, yeah, quite a lot of sense for a number of reasons here.
And comparing it to something like Salesforce, which is a fairly, I mean, Salesforce has like the best marketing department ever. When you actually use Salesforce software, you sort of, it's powerful but clunky is how I would describe it. It looks old hat. It kind of runs old hat, but it does kind of in the same way that Amazon used to look for a period of time, where you used to go into Amazon and it was one of the worst websites to look at in the world, but functionally it was incredible, fast, responsive. You always seemed to get where you wanted to and be able to buy what you wanted and it turned up the next day. That's kind of the Salesforce kind of, you know, how their software kind of works. You can understand though people who need more sort of visuals, why they swapped to Atlassian's Jira software and why Monday.com is just doing so well in smaller teams. It is an incredibly visual product. I we've toyed with using it on the Playing Footsie show before. I've put together a Monday.com and then realized that because there is a free version, in order to share it with anybody, you have to pay for it. So we soon scrapped that, considering for 3 years and 4 months of this show's inception, we essentially had no money. Even so, we probably still wouldn't buy it now. But it is a very interesting product, Steve. It's a product that I like a lot. There's two incumbents in there that I would have said are really well entrenched, and they're growing at 30% a year. So this is a period of time as well where, you know, we're not seeing the sort of VC-backed startups going live and the SPAC deals are dying off somewhat. So, you know, the money is draining out of these sort of VC-backed startups that you would have, assume are the people that would, you know, they would float towards your Atlassians and your Monday.com. And yet, Monday.com is still growing. And yes, some of that is the net dollar retention rate that we discussed earlier. But, you know, there's new business coming into Monday.com as well. And that must mean they're taking market share here and there, stealing bits and bobs. And if you pop onto the Monday.com website, they'll show you all of the customers they've got. And you'll look down that list and say, some people here are dual using. I think some people are using Monday.com alongside Salesforce. And if some of those people stop using things like Salesforce and Atlassian and move on to Monday.com, then this business could continue to grow for a really long time. It's a really interesting business for me. If I was looking to inject a bit more risk into my portfolio, I think this is probably where I would head.
Interesting. I mean, when I look at Monday.com and I now look at its kind of market cap as being about 11 billion, I sort of think, I kind of wonder with these, I remember it not being so long ago that Salesforce was buying Slack in a move that was, I think, mixed success eventually. But I sort of automatically assume that with these things, any of them that becomes sufficiently good is going to get bought by Microsoft, especially if they have an 11 billion market cap or even a 9 billion market cap, which they had just before they kind of had a big bounce kind of earlier this week. They still feel to me in kind of viable range, to be honest, with sort of acquisition possibilities. I kind of wonder whether it's the case that something here wins and then gets brought into a Microsoft ecosystem, where it seems like nearly every business has some sort of working relationship with Microsoft, even the one I work for, does, and it's like a billion years old. And we do stuff on like Teams, and people have decided to keep sending me Teams messages all over the place, and I'm supposed to pay attention to these things, and I do my best, but it's I haven't really got the hang of decentralized working terribly well. But I feel like Microsoft is the place that tends to pick up things in this and turn them into winners or buy the winners.
Here's what I think. I think Google is the good fit for Monday.com, just mm-hmm. thinking out loud on that note. Because of Google's workspace, the way they've moved Docs and Google Meet and, a few Google products under this and Drive into this Google workspace banner, surely the next thing that you'd want to tack into all of those services, something that would improve them all, Gmail has moved in as well, obviously, is Monday.com, something that could tie together, you know, the planning of these things with the execution of them, and £10 billion, Google probably sneezes that out on accident on a given week. So I wonder if it's on the radar. I wonder if Google, because I mean, Lina Khan, what a time to buy something. Lina Khan has lost absolutely everything that she's put forward to cost, and now I wonder if all of these companies are looking at the fact that, you know, Lina Khan is so weak in terms of the things that she's promised to do versus what she's delivered, which is nothing. And wondering, I don't know, I wonder if like we could get this across the line. It's a show of weakness in the Trade Department at the moment. That even when stuff's been blocked, people have just pushed forward with the deals and started to integrate the companies because they know on appeal they're likely to win. I'm thinking out loud about Grail with Illumina here and a couple of things and obviously the derision at the moment over the two handbag companies that they've tried to stop merging despite, you know, there not really being any kind of conglomerates or any kind of monopoly in handbags. It seems like the wrong place for somebody to focus on, but it's another case that I think they will lose. And I think she will end up leaving that job with a pretty diminished reputation, which is a shame because when she came, we thought Lina Khan was going to do some good things. Google, get on Monday.com. That's up there with my Deckers to buy Dot Martin, Steve. That would be on my wish list of acquires, I think.
That little bounce might not have helped you, actually, but you, of course, own both of those, Google and Monday.com. I was just having a look, actually. I never really realized that Atlassian is probably too big to buy. It's a sort of 46 billion market cap thing. That's about four times the size of Monday.com. So if someone's looking to buy one of these things, either a Microsoft or a Google for the time being, doesn't really matter which one. The one that's getting bought there is Monday. Pretty clearly from what I can see of it, that's interesting. I mean, I don't buy things for, especially not that kind of, that level of speculative arbitrage opportunity that I think it might be a decent idea. Otherwise, I would be I would own a lot more Burberry shares than I do, which is to say I own none, but I would own a lot more Burberry shares than I do if I thought acquisition were a thing, or I'd just buy a UK ETF and watch the entire thing disappear in the space of about 4 years. We should probably pause there, Steve. We're well through the hour mark. We actually recorded this in two little bits, and the thing's saying 104 at the moment. We've got the bit from the beginning too. So perhaps I'll come back to the other thing that I had for this week next time out. It's not super urgent. It's not super exciting, but there are some things to have a look at there along the way. So for now, we will be back with more next week. I'm Steve. That was Steve. Thank you all very much for listening. Check us out down below and have a look at Trading212 and finchat.io. We will see you next week.